Welcome to our super special extra spooky Halloween edition of All Movie Talk. This is episode 5 for Halloween, October 31st. We've got a special episode centered, of course, around Halloween today. We're going to talk about top 6 horror movies, where what's scary is not what you see, but rather what you don't see. Sam has promised me a Halloween-related trivia question. We're going to talk about M. Night Shyamalan's The Village. Sam's going to explain, well, attempt to explain anyway, why it's a good movie. And not Halloween related, but still interesting. We're going to continue our James Bond discussion with a look at the Roger Moore era. And we have a good bad movie for you, Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. One of the most patently ridiculous horror films of all time. And when you say ridiculous horror films, that's saying a lot. I'm Stephen Keller.
And I'm Sam... Boo!
Ah! Oh, wow. Sorry, I was frightened.
Oh,
got me, man.
Man, that was hilarious. Okay, well, I am Sam Stoddard. But I scared the ever-loving daylights out of you, didn't I?
Yeah, pretty much.
Movies are obviously a very visual medium, and so it's something of a paradox that sometimes the scariest movies are scary because of what they don't show you, rather than what actually appears on the screen. A lot of horror movies weaken themselves by making the mistake of showing the viewer too much, because it's often said our deepest rooted fear is the fear of the unknown. And so if movies suggest scary things, playing off the fear of the unknown, they tend to be scarier than movies that show us what we're supposed to be afraid of. So this week's top 6 list is the top 6 horror movies where what's scary is what we don't actually see on the screen.
So these are going to be Jason movies, right?
Yeah, the 6 best Friday the 13th films.
I can't really restrict it to 6. I got to take the entire series. They're all wonderful.
That's cheating.
Well,
I should explain we're doing a top 6 list instead of a top 5 list because 6 movies is one scarier than 5 movies. So that brings us to my number 6. My number 6 pick is my favorite movie in the recent Japanese new wave of horror. It's called The Eye, which is admittedly a curious title for a list of horror movies that are not about visuals. And I was conflicted about whether to include this or not because it does rely on a lot of visuals and vision in general. It's about a blind woman who regains her sight through a corneal transplant. Now, she's been blind since she was 2 years old, so part of the process of adjusting to sight is figuring out how to correlate her familiar sense of touch with her totally alien sense of sight. This is a fascinating process, but the problem is she's perhaps seeing some things that other people can't see at all, and she doesn't know what to make of that. We, the audience, are quicker at identifying what she's seeing than she is, and some of these things are pretty terrifying. But the reason I'm including this movie on my list is that the scariest scenes all seem to be about things we don't quite see, even though we know they're there. For example, the woman gets in an elevator and then it becomes apparent that she's not alone in that elevator. So who's in there just behind her? Well, we see one thing and another, a pair of feet that just aren't quite right. What's terrifying is, what kind of thing do those feet belong to? We can't see it, so we don't know, and so we don't know what it might do, what kind of danger this woman is in or not. So even though this movie is all about vision, it still abides by the rule of thumb that what's scary is what we can't see, or in this case, what's really there even when our own vision is not trustworthy. By the way, the absolute best way to see this movie, not to bring up the debate about movie theaters we had last week again, but the best way to see this is to watch this on a laptop or one of those flip-top DVD players with a good pair of headphones in the dark. You get the screen right up close and the audio right at your ears, and it makes the movie close and intimate and immediate. You don't want the scariness across the room or across the theater. You want it right there in your lap. One of the best times I've ever had with a horror movie was watching The Eye under those conditions.
That sounds pretty intriguing. I have to admit, I haven't seen it because I've avoided these Japanese horror movies sort of like The Plague as well as their American remakes, but that sounds like something I would really enjoy. My number 6 movie is probably something that a lot of people are going to disagree with me on, and that's The Blair Witch Project from 1999 by directors Daniel Myrick and Eduardo Sanchez. It was a huge hit in 99. And, of course, it's one of those things where, because it was a huge hit, now everybody hates it. I really enjoyed it. It was a movie that really creeped me the heck out for a little while afterward, and the last scene is the only time where you maybe see something, but what you see isn't really... It's hard to describe what you see, and certainly not ghosts or goblins or scenes of graphic violence. The entire movie is effective through atmosphere and through suggesting things. We hear sounds that are just out of our reach. We find evidence that maybe something creepy was going on. Strange occurrences happen, but we never ever actually see anything. Now, part of this is probably because of the super low budget the movie was made for, but it was also a very conscious decision on the filmmaker's parts. You know, a lot of the movie, kind of famously, is improvisational. The actors allegedly didn't really know exactly what was happening, and so some of their freaked-out behavior is allegedly kind of real. I don't know how much of that's really true and how much of it's marketing buzz, but nonetheless, I think it's an effective movie that is still pretty scary.
Yeah. My number five pick is an absolute gem of a film, a bit more polished than the Blair Witch Project. It's called The Others, a 2001 film starring Nicole Kidman at her absolute best. She is fantastic here as a woman whose husband is off fighting World War II, and she's taking care of her two children. Both children suffer from an extreme photosensitivity, which basically means that prolonged exposure to sunlight could be life-threatening. So the house is sealed tight, all the windows stay covered, and everybody has to be careful to keep the doors closed, that sort of thing. But as things progress, it seems that maybe they aren't the only people in this house. For a while, the movie follows the haunted house formula that's familiar but no less scary for it, and then ultimately branches off in a different kind of direction. This movie is criticized sometimes for being too similar to another famous horror movie, although it would be a spoiler to say which, so I won't. Suffice it to say that I think these criticisms are totally unfair because The Others explores the idea in a totally original way. Anyway, the movie was scary for me in an unusually satisfying way, and it's done mostly with sounds and brilliant cinematography that hides more than it shows, but seldom ever feels like it's hiding anything. It's really very well done.
I like The Others too, though. I wouldn't say that it actually really scared me very much. I thought it was an interesting kind of psychological drama with a cool ending, but I don't know. I like ghost movies, I guess. I like haunted house movies, and it was creepy, but I don't know that it ever really frightened me at all. Maybe I'm just a little too jaded, I don't know.
I think a lot of these movies, it depends on the atmosphere you see it in, and certainly the type of person you are. I think, you know, they say comedy is subjective. I think horror is even more subjective.
Yeah, I would agree. Well, my number five movie is another movie that didn't terrify me the way maybe it should have, and that is Psycho from 1960, and of course directed by Alfred Hitchcock. Very famously, this movie shows very little. It does hint strongly at the violence, and there's, of course, the infamous shower scene in which the heroine is attacked by an assailant that we don't actually get to see. Instead, we see cut together very quickly a series of images, a hand with a knife coming down, the heroine screaming, the hand with the knife, sharp chords screeching on the soundtrack, and then, you know, blood swirling down a shower drain. In fact, you never actually see what you think you see, which is a knife hitting flesh. Part of it is because in 1960, Hitchcock is still operating under the Motion Picture Production Code and kind of has to skirt around what he was allowed to show, but in not actually showing the violence, they very famously creeped everyone out. People were terrified to take showers if they had seen it. No one had ever seen a slasher movie before. Psycho is pretty much the first slasher flick, and, you know, one of the first horror movies to hint at graphic violence the way that it did. But my problem is, of course, by the time I saw it, I knew everything about it. And, you know, I think I saw it when I was 14 or something, but still, even then, I knew everything about it because it's such a famous movie. So I think it's hard to appreciate today how terrifying it almost certainly was in 1960.
Yeah, and of course, if you know The Secret of Norman Bates, it kind of saps the tension right out of it because you know who's safe and who's not at different times. My number four, it is said that the genius of Jaws was how the shark was not really seen until the end, and until then you only see these little suggestions that the shark is there, a fin in the water, or somebody being pulled around in the water from underneath. One of the scariest sequences in the movie doesn't have the shark on the scene at all, but you never know when he might suddenly appear out of the gloom. The success of this filmmaking strategy was partly Spielberg's understanding of the fear of the unseen, but it was also partly accidental. Spielberg originally wanted to show a bit more of the shark, but the mechanical robot shark they had famously kept breaking.
Right.
It malfunctioned so persistently that for a while they were afraid the studio was going to pull the plug on the whole project because it was just getting so expensive to keep fixing this thing. Well, that didn't happen, and Spielberg worked around the lack of a working shark by writing him out of key scenes and instead using suggestive editing techniques, and boy, do they work.
They sure did. You know, my number four movie, just coincidentally, is also Jaws. We didn't actually collaborate on this, it just so happened. I think the best example of this is the very opening sequence with the two teenagers. This woman and this boy run off from the campfire, and the woman strips off her clothes and jumps in the water, and the boy is, like, drunk and passes out on the beach, and she's just sort of treading water by herself. And then we see this underwater shot, and we start hearing the infamous John Williams score, and all of a sudden the woman drops underneath the water. The camera is actually positioned right on top of the water as though we were swimming in it with her, and she drops down and disappears, and she comes up and is gasping for breath and starts screaming and then drops down once or twice more and then that's it and the water is still again, or as still as it can be on a beach, just gently lapping waves. And it's sort of that terrifying, what the heck just happened? With even creepier, though, is the stillness after it. Like, did anything terrible just happen or not? And throughout the movie, Spielberg treats the shark just like that. There's the other great sequence toward the end of the film where the three men are chasing the shark on the boat, and they've plugged it with these floating barrels so they can tell where the shark is, and it's underwater, and as it goes, the barrels move around. But all we see, really, are these barrels moving, and Spielberg manages to make floating barrels absolutely terrifying.
Yeah. And, you know, I think another thing here that makes this movie scary is the fact that we have water. Water is kind of scary because we can't really see too far under the surface. You know, if you're wading through the water, you don't know what's down where your feet are being planted. And, of course, we imagine all kinds of things floating around in the water, and sometimes the tricks of the light and seaweed or whatever makes us think there's something down there. So the fact that we don't ever really know if there's something that close to us that might be threatening is, I think, part of what makes water scary.
Especially since this is a shared experience. You know, we've all been to the beach, I think. Most people have, or at least a lake. You know what it's like to be swimming around with other living creatures, and it is kind of weird. It's not like a haunted house movie. I've never been in a haunted house on account of they're not real, but I have been to the beach lots of times, and so definitely when you watch Jaws, it's tapping into experiences you have personally had.
Yes. And speaking of haunted house movies, my number 3 is one of the best haunted house movies ever made. It's a subgenre that's probably a little too restrictive to allow for a lot of great movies, but this is one that proves it can be done well. It's called The Changeling from 1980, and it stars George C. Scott as a composer whose wife and daughter have been killed. Now, he moves into this huge mansion of a house, and creepy things start to happen. This is one of the scariest of all horror movies, with the caveat that, like most scary movies, it may not be scary unless you watch it in the right atmosphere, as we mentioned before, but under the right conditions, this is terrifying, and very little of that impact is achieved by visuals. I think the main ingredient here is sound. This movie makes a wonderful use of sound, not the least of which are the beautiful piano melodies that Scott's character plays on his piano as he's composing. This is about a composer, and so music becomes sort of an integral part of this. Not an explicit part of the plot, but an integral part of the atmosphere. But there are subtler uses of sound, too. One of the creepiest scenes is a seance in which a medium falls into a trance, and her hand is holding a pencil that's scratching away at a pad of paper very frantically, and another person is holding paper under her pencil so that it would draw something, and when the paper fills up, he snatches it away, and then it starts writing on the paper underneath that. And so it's nonstop, scribble, 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 and that sound of the pencil against the paper is amplified into quite a haunting, mesmerizing, rhythmic sound. That's just one example of how this movie uses sound to accomplish its scares. But a great movie, not a lot based on visuals at all, though.
Interesting. My number 3 pick is also a haunted house movie of a sort, and that's 1979's Alien by Ridley Scott. It's, of course, a haunted house movie that just so happens to take place on a spaceship. And, I mean, I may be cheating a little bit here, because you do see quite a bit of the creature, the alien, as well as there's some pretty violent parts, but those don't really come until the end. The vast majority of the movie is this alien creature terrorizing the inhabitants of this spaceship, and it ducks behind dark corridors, and the creature hatches, you know, very famously out of a guy's chest, but after that point, we don't see it a whole lot. It's cloaked in shadow when it looks weird, and it's growing very rapidly and changing into its mature form. I think if you watch it today, of course, some of that impact is lost because we all know what the alien looks like after the next 3 Alien movies show us in great detail. When, of course, at the very end of the movie, you get a good look at it too. But it's still, for much of the movie, just these characters walking around these dark corridors as this unknown thing stalks them. It's helped by the creature design, which, you know, Alien is one of the few alien movies where the alien doesn't look like a human with some plastic junk on his face. It's this disturbing creature that has endless amounts of teeth and no eyes and just looks downright creepy. Of course, H.R. Giger, the artist known for his twisted stuff, was specially recruited to design a lot of the sets and the creature itself, and so the art direction is perfect, and it works well because we feel real close attachment to these characters who seem like actual human people, which is interesting for a science fiction movie. These are just like normal blue-collar guys who work hauling around mining ore and get in something way above their heads. They don't have awesome plasma rifles to shoot the creature with. They're stuck and being stalked by something. And it taps into some, you know, very primal fears of being chased by unknown predators in the dark.
Yeah, you know what else? We were just talking about water, and it occurs to me that water also plays an important role here, but a very different role. There's a lot of the sets seem to have dripping water here, and the sound and the look and the, you know, the way the light reflects off it adds to the atmosphere.
Right.
So it's kind of strange that water seems to be a versatile horror element.
Sure. And of course, we also have the great scenes in Alien with the dripping acid blood of the alien, right? It burns holes right through the ship, which is just, you know, a wonderful invention. And that creepy drippiness. The alien, I think, famously has all that saliva. And yeah, there is something, I guess I hadn't thought about either, something creepy about water.
Keeps coming up in these movies, yeah. My number two is called The Shining from 1980, and it's one of the scariest movies I've seen, but you know, when I remember it, I can't quite figure out why. It's about a family spending the winter in a humongous empty hotel, and there's a mystery about something that happened years and years ago, and one of the characters is for some reason behaving oddly. So, sounds terrifying, right? Well, somehow it is, and heck if I can come up with a rational explanation why, director Stanley Kubrick is just so good at creating a profound sense of unease through things like sound editing and surreal cinematography. I think one of the more interesting elements of cinematography is his use of the Steadicam. This is the first movie that used a Steadicam very extensively, and so we have these sweeping tracking shots down the halls of this empty hotel, and it just creates a very creepy, not right atmosphere to it. Very scary, and when you think about it, there's not a lot that you actually see that's scary.
You're absolutely right. In fact, it works, I think, because there's a lot of psychological elements, and I picked The Shining as my top film, so I'll get to that in a second. My number two pick is Don't Look Now, the 1973 film by Nicholas Roeg. It stars Julie Christie and Donald Sutherland as parents who recently lost their little daughter and have since moved to Venice, and they're trying to get on with their lives, trying to put this loss behind them, when they meet these pair of women who claim to be psychics and claim to be seeing flashes of their daughter. And Donald Sutherland's like, well, that doesn't sound reasonable. He's a rational person. And then he starts seeing these images as he goes around Venice of this girl in a red hooded jacket, like the one his daughter wore the day she died. And he starts seeing his wife in these weird images and starts seeing things, and you're never really sure what's going on. The movie is never, in fact, clear at all about what's going on. It feels very dreamlike, but it perfectly uses Venice. And again, we have water with the canals that shows up again here, and these old buildings, some of which are gorgeous. And Sutherland's character, I don't think coincidentally, is working on restoring artwork and old buildings. And so there's some good setup scenes with, you know, him on a ladder. But there's never really like a killer stalking anyone. There is one scene of some graphic violence, but it's completely unexpected, and that's why it's so effective. So I won't say when it occurs or what happens. Most of the movie just builds up this very, very creepy, very intense atmosphere that is definitely aided by the fact that the movie is sort of about this loss of a daughter. And I think we've all dealt with loss in our personal lives and the loss of loved ones. And here, director Nicholas Roeg really turns it into something even creepier. And what if, like, you couldn't just get past that? What if you were trying to move past it, but you kept seeing the person you lost, but you weren't sure you were seeing it? What would that do to you? How terrifying would that be?
Yeah, this is a great pick for this category. It definitely conveys a profound sense of unease. I was disappointed with it. The ending, I don't think really, you know, I think you have to enjoy this in spite of the ending rather than because of it. So maybe if I were to go back and see it again with those expectations kind of fixed based on what I know, how I know it's going to turn out, I would appreciate it more. But I definitely, definitely loved the atmosphere in this movie. It's got a wonderful atmosphere to it. And yeah, I think you said it all about that, about how it builds it and what it's like. It's certainly an alien setting for most of us. Most of us do not live in Venice or even in a city with canals as streets. We don't tend to live in cities with architecture so ubiquitous and old and with such a character to it. But that really adds to this movie somehow. I'm not entirely sure how it does it, but great atmosphere to this, and I was really creeped out.
Like I said, I don't think the profession or the setting is all coincidental. Venice is a city that's constantly sinking. It's constantly having to fight against and build upwards, and it's this great old city that's just constantly decaying. And I think that's sort of, in a way, a metaphor for the life of the Donald Sutherland character, whose marriage has been deeply damaged by this loss and who they just can't quite rebuild as much as they might try. And that's, I think, a lot of the terror comes from.
Yep. Well, that brings me to my number one, which is not the 1952 Kirk Douglas film The Bad and the Beautiful, which isn't even a horror movie, but this gives me a good lead-in. The movie is a frame tale about a Hollywood producer, and there's a bit where the producer and a director are assigned to a low-budget horror movie about cat creatures. And the costume designer demos these incredibly goofy-looking cat costumes. I mean, they're laughable. And they're sitting there thinking, oh no, we're sunk. This movie's going to be terrible. Everybody's going to be laughing at us. They're not going to be scared at all. And the problem is they can't spend more money on better effects, and they can't bail out of the movie either. So they're brainstorming, trying to figure out how to save their careers, and finally one of them hits upon the idea of not showing the cats at all, but instead using lighting and editing to suggest monsters in the shadows and provoke the audience's imagination. Well, the idea works, and the movie is a big hit. I tell this story because this is more or less actually what happened with the 1942 cult classic called Cat People, about a woman who turns into a violent panther whenever she becomes attracted to a man. The panther isn't seen at all until the end, but unless you're paying attention, this doesn't necessarily stand out because the movie is so good at the power of suggestion that it really feels like the panther is present throughout. Most famously, the pool sequence involves a woman swimming in an indoor pool at night. Here's water again. And what light there is reflects off the water and all over the walls and ceiling of this otherwise dark room, and it becomes clear that something is out there in the darkened perimeter of this room, just on the edge of the pool, and maybe stalking this woman. Now, water is scary enough, but here's a rare horror movie scene where the water is the safe place to be. Most people probably wouldn't consider Cat People scary in the modern sense, and although I picked it from my number one, it's undoubtedly the least scary of any of the movies we've talked about on this segment, but I made it my number one because it's such a pure demonstration of how thick a creepy atmosphere you can build up without actually showing much of anything on the screen, and regardless of how scary it is, it's still very effective from a psychological perspective.
Interesting. Yeah, I haven't seen it. I know about the movie, but I didn't realize that it was actually you considered it such a good movie. I always sort of thought it's a cult movie, but
it is very definitely a B movie, but it's like a good B movie.
I see. Well, I'll have to check it out sometime. It sounds interesting. Well, we mentioned The Shining before, and I already gave it away, so that's my number one pick. I'd like to note something about The Shining. A couple months ago, I sat down and watched it in the dark. Of course, I've seen it before that. But I don't know that I ever really watched in the right atmosphere, and it's one of those movies, again, that it's a cultural icon, kind of like Psycho or Alien or Jaws or really half the movies that we've talked about, that I think if you've grown up in the last couple of decades, you know about these movies, they're just with you. But The Shining impressed me how much it really stood up, even though I'd seen it before and knew all the surprises. When you really watch it from beginning to end on DVD in a dark room and just let it work on you, it's really effective. It's much creepier than I remembered it being. And I think mainly it's creepy because it's about a guy going crazy and the idea that it could happen to us. The story, of course, based on a Stephen King novel. Stephen King sort of wrote it as a metaphor for the way alcoholism and addiction works. The movie sort of goes past that, and it's just about the idea that people can go crazy and do terrible things. And interestingly, we're never 100% certain what has happened. Certainly, it seems that the hotel has some supernatural stuff going on, but I don't know that you can be 100% certain. There are a lot of interesting theories out there. Notice that any time the Jack Nicholson character is talking to a supernatural being, there's also a mirror in the room. So is he talking to himself, or what's going on? And of course, a lot of really great iconic images. The scene that became the trailer, the blood just slowly pouring out of the hotel elevator. This image that doesn't really make a ton of sense within the strict context of the plot, but it works perfectly to build this atmosphere of death and decay and just terrible things that have happened, and the idea that this hotel has a real sense of memory of all the bad things that have happened.
You know why it didn't really fit in with the context of the story of the movie is because it was shot originally as a trailer that would not appear in the movie, and Stanley Kubrick saw the footage and said, oh, you know, that's really good. I'm going to use it in the movie.
Well, it does work, though. If the end of the movie, I don't know what to do with. The big climax, there's a bunch of things that you see that you don't really understand, and there's that scene with the two men, and one of them's wearing a bear costume, which sounds like it should be comical, but man, it's terrifying when you see it, and I have no idea exactly what's going on in that scene at all. I've read some theories that I guess there's some stuff in the book that clears it up, but yeah, the movie just works mainly because it sets a mood and gets inside our heads.
I think another important thing about this movie is the sense of isolation you get. You're in the middle of nowhere, and so if you need help, it's not coming, and you can't get out anywhere.
Exactly.
So let's recap the movies we've talked about. My number six choice is The Eye from 2002. My number five is The Others from 2001. Number four, Jaws from 1975. Number three, The Changeling from 1980. Number two, The Shining, also from 1980. And number one, Cat People from 1942.
And my top six list is Blair Witch Project from 1999, Psycho from 1960, Jaws in 1975, Alien from 1979, Don't Look Now from 1973, and my number one pick was Stanley Kubrick's The Shining from 1980.
This week I thought we'd ratchet down the difficulty level on these trivia questions and do kind of a fun one. This is a three-parter. I'm going to quote three famous scary musical motifs, and you have to come up with the horror franchise it came from. Are you ready for this?
Absolutely.
Okay, number one. Ring, ring, ring! Do you recognize that?
Yeah, and I really like our high production values on all movie talk, Sam. I'd like to note that we spare no expense on providing you guys in the listening audience with the absolute best.
Yeah, and you'd never know it, but that was actually just me mouthing the notes there.
Wow.
I was humming them, kind of.
Amazing.
It sounds realistic. Number two, da-dum. That's just two notes, but that's all I'm going to give you.
I think I got it.
Number three,
oh, yeah, you did that wrong, though. It's really more like...
But you did it wrong, too, because there's only three of each repetition.
Oh, you're right. So it's more like...
Yeah, but you got to work on the production values on your end.
Oh, well, maybe.
Well, anyway, we'll find out what the answers are at the end of the show. But, Steven, what's your prediction on how many you're going to get right?
I think I'm going to go 3 for 3 this time. It's a new record.
All right. Well, if you miss any... I think you'll definitely unqualified to host a Halloween show, and so I'm just going to do all the rest of the segments on this episode.
Well, I answer at the end, so that's going to foil your little plan.
I better host them all anyway, just in case.
Gotcha.
It's time for a segment called Controversial Take. That is a segment where one of us has an opinion that is probably wrong, but we hold it dearly, and we will defend it to our dying day. And this week, I will confess and defend the unusual opinion that M. Night Shyamalan's The Village is actually a good film. Can you believe that, Steven?
No, I've been bugging you for like a year now to explain to me why you think it's a good movie.
Well, now I'll get my chance. So, first of all, I do admit that this is a pretty big step down from his previous three thrillers, The Sixth Sense, Unbreakable, and Signs, all of which I loved, but I think this is pretty good. Now, in the film, just to give you guys a bit of background if you don't already know, The Village is an isolated rural village in 19th century America. It's not so much more than a cluster of a few houses and farms in the middle of a vast expanse of woods. And there's a bit of melodrama that results in the need for one of the characters to seek medical aid from a neighboring area in the outside world. But it goes without saying that all is not what it seems. The elders in the village seem to be reluctant to permit any contact with the outside world, and in any case, there seems to be some kind of dangerous creatures out there that don't want the villagers trespassing in their woods. Now, when the movie came out in 2004, expectations were huge. It came on the heels of three incredibly well-received thrillers from Shyamalan, and just the fact that The Village was not near their equal doomed it to a pretty disappointing reception, and in fact, that's what happened. Audiences turned out for the opening weekend, and word of mouth just killed it afterward. The audience dropped off like you'd never believe, and critics just savaged it. Roger Ebert named it the 10th worst film of the year, seemingly mostly because of a plot twist or two at the end, which I'll try to discuss without revealing. So, I have 2 points I want to talk about how I feel with this movie. The first one isn't really an argument, it's just an offer to agree to disagree with anybody who would like to disagree with me. I just like the character drama. Many people thought it would move too slow and was boring, and I can kind of see why, but for me, I thought the way the movie takes its time to build a particular kind of haunting atmosphere was pretty compelling, and ultimately, I found a lot of the moments in here really creepy and suspenseful. There's a couple of shots that are made, especially by the cinematography, that are are kind of chilling and unexpected, even if you expect them anyway. So it's gorgeous to look at. Very good cinematography. I don't think you can argue with that one too much. Very nice colors and stuff, which is pretty typical, I guess, with Shyamalan movies. But I think thrillers can sometimes be even more subjective than comedy. You know how some people find something hilarious and other people not at all. I think thrillers can be more that way because it depends not only on who you are, but your mood and the environment that you watch the movie in. For me, this one built the tension. This one, I think, worked in that respect just as an entertaining thriller.
Well, let me jump in here. I think there are a couple moments that, like you said, are suspenseful and well-crafted. Unfortunately for me, those moments are broken up by these interminable dialogue sequences about characters that I might be willing to care about if the dialogue weren't so awful and wooden. And, oh man, this weird faux 19th century dialect that Shyamalan tries to write is a huge failure. It doesn't succeed on any level, either the level of why it would sound like that because of the plot, or just as engaging dialogue. I honestly don't think Shyamalan has ever been a good writer of dialogue. Aside from the line, "I see dead people," can you name a single quotable moment from any Shyamalan film?
Not off the top of my head. I would agree with you there. He's not really about the quotable dialogue. And I do think that the writing is the weak part. I think he comes up with great stories, and he should let somebody else write the scripts for them, and then he should direct them.
Yeah, and I agree with you with the cinematography. I'm a huge Roger Deakins fan, who's the director of photography for The Village, and I love it. I think it's the best looking of the Shyamalan movies, but unfortunately, the dialogue really just killed all of the non-thriller moments for me, and there are a lot of non-thriller moments in this movie. I can sympathize with a movie wanting to set up its characters and take its time, and I like a good slow movie like that, but in this case, I didn't find it interesting at all. None of the characters worked for me, especially the Adrian Brody character, who I just thought was annoying, and then the resolution with him, I just thought was stupid and not interesting.
Well, like I say at the beginning of this, this is just something we'll agree to disagree on. But I want to move on to talking about what I think is a kind of an interesting message that this movie has. I don't think this is just a thriller that is entertaining, although I would have been happy if that's all it was. But I think the message of this movie is pretty compelling, and I never really saw it discussed much when it came out, so it's kind of too bad, because I think the movie actually has something timely to say and to think about. And that touches on isolationism, immigration. Basically, does it really make sense for humanity to group itself into isolated communities and wall away everything else? This comes up a lot in America's history. Do we open the borders? Do we close the borders? Do we reach out to countries around us or withdraw within ourselves and focus inward? And I think the real answer is of balance and moderation. But I think there are a lot of people out there arguing for one extreme or the other, and I think The Village is a strong argument against the isolationist extreme, especially in light of the plot twists that occur toward the end that people complained about. To me, that's what really drives home the point here, and I think it makes this story work all the better as an allegory. It's just not a viable way to live, to cut yourself off from the rest of humanity. If you do that, even if it's to preserve a particular way of life and you find the rest of the world distasteful in some way, ultimately you're still going to hurt yourself because you're going to fail in that attempt and something else is going to come up. You're going to need to keep connected to the outside world.
You know, I could get behind the idea of the movie as a metaphor and get more interested in that if it weren't cloaked in 2.5 hours of the most mind-numbing dialogue I could ever imagine.
Oh. No, wait, we already talked about that. What do you have to say about this?
Sure, that's great, but it's should be interesting, right? Somewhat compelling as a movie, but it completely fails. I guess I can see that point, but so the movie has an interesting point. That doesn't make it worth watching. Plenty of bad movies try to make points.
Certainly, but not necessarily. I just think, for me, I didn't have the problem with the dialogue. I don't think it's great dialogue, but I didn't have the problem with the dialogue that you had, I guess, and that, I guess, enabled me to enjoy it and kind of take in what it has to offer. But, you know, I enjoyed the pace of this. I know you're saying it's slow. I think a lot of slow movies can be the worst things, but if they build a particular kind of feeling or atmosphere, that's compelling to me. And so I guess if that worked for me, obviously the cinematography was going to, and obviously that was going to open my mind toward the message of the movie and the thriller components of it. Does it come down to whether we are annoyed by the dialogue or not?
It's not just the dialogue. It's also the characters who are bland and uninteresting and some uneven performances. Adrian Brody.
Did you like Bryce Dallas Howard?
I did, actually. I think she did a good job. And, yeah, she's a really talented young actress. I can't wait to see what she's in next, though I of course, did see what she was in next, and I also hated it, and that was The Lady in the Water.
Well, I haven't seen that yet. Maybe we'll do another one of these segments on that.
No, because I don't think even you are capable of rationalizing that movie away.
All right, well, we'll see. Over the last 2 weeks, we've been recapping the James Bond series in anticipation of the release of Casino Royale on November 17th. When we left off last week, the Bond series was in severe jeopardy. It was at a critical and commercial low, people still weren't sure if anybody but Sean Connery could carry the role, and one of the two producers of the series from the beginning, Harry Saltzman, sold his interest in the franchise and bailed out. Meanwhile, the director for the previous three episodes, Guy Hamilton, left the series when he was given a chance to direct Superman. Of course, that deal fell through, too. But in the meantime, they had to find a new director. Also, what's happening at this time, Kevin McClory re-enters the picture. If you'll recall, McClory owned the film rights to the story of Thunderball, and he co-produced the film in 1965 with the regular producers, and under the terms of their agreement, McClory would not try to remake the film for at least 10 years, and Eon Productions would get to use Spectre and the character Blofeld in the main series. Well, this agreement expires right after The Man with the Golden Gun, and in 1976, McClory tries to start producing an original James Bond adventure called Warhead, and starring Sean Connery. Well, right away, United Artists files suit to put a stop to that, and they are successful, but this is just one more threat to the main Bond series. But in the end credits of The Man with the Golden Gun, the traditional promise appears. In this case, James Bond will return in The Spy Who Loved Me. Broccoli took his time, 3 years, to take his first shot at producing Solo and to try to rescue the Bond series from its tailspin, and wouldn't you know it, he's wildly successful. The Spy Who Loved Me was directed by Lewis Gilbert, who had previously done You Only Live Twice, and this is the film where Roger Moore really comes into his own in the role, and the series itself successfully adapts to the 1970s. It has a nice, polished look to it, which the previous three movies lack, and it was released in 1977. The story is the first wholly original story in the film series. Well, unless you count that it's largely derivative If You Only Live Twice, the movie. But, see, the novel of The Spy Who Loved Me is kind of an oddball. Bond doesn't even show up until toward the end, and it wasn't that popular with fans, and Fleming had requested that only the title of the book be used. So the producers took the title, and also the idea of a henchman with steel-capped teeth, and wrote an original screenplay. The villain was originally going to be Blofeld, but Kevin McClory filed an injunction on the use of Blofeld, and so the villain was changed to somebody named Carl Stromberg, who's essentially the same character without the Persian cat. But anyway, except for some wooden acting, mostly on the part of Barbara Bach, who plays Agent Triple X, and also the weird disco-funk soundtrack by Marvin Hamlisch, Where's John Barry When You Need Him?, The Spy Who Loved Me is a very good movie. It's certainly the best Bond film from the 1970s, and it finds just the right tone and look for the material to make it entertaining. There's humor, but Bond still has the edge he needs. There's also one of the series' most memorable henchmen in the form of Jaws, the big, tall mute with those steel-capped teeth I mentioned earlier. When I was young, Jaws terrified me. He really made an impression.
Hey, Agent Triple X, that's a pretty clever pun.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
I wonder where that came from.
I don't know.
It's so unlike the series to do things like that with the names of the women. Anyway, the other particularly noteworthy part of this movie is the spectacular pre-credit scene. It's a ski scene that ends in an incredible free-fall jump off a cliff that is just so perfectly put together. As soon as Bond skis off the cliff, the music stops and you hear nothing but the wind as he falls, and after a while a parachute opens up and he has the Union Jack emblazoned all over it, and the Bond theme bursts out, and I mean, how perfectly Bondian is that? Audiences must have known, even before the opening credits, that Bond was finally back.
But not to stay for very long, right? Because I think the next movie coming up is not really the highlight of the series.
Not at all. It's, of course, Moonraker. But the credits at the end of The Spy Who Loved Me promise that James Bond will return in For Your Eyes Only. But something happened in the meantime. Star Wars came out and reaped box office rewards nobody thought possible, and everybody started making space movies. The Last Starfighter, The Black Hole, Battlestar Galactica, Star Trek The Motion Picture, and Moonraker. Now, the novel of Moonraker is just about a rocket. But hey, space opera is in, so why not launch Bond into outer space? So Moonraker was released in 1979 with Lewis Gilbert returning to the director's chair, and it's just awful. Stupid slapstick kills everything right from the very promising pre-credit skydiving sequence. which is really frustrating because many elements of the film are pretty good. There's a wonderful scene where Bond is trapped in a centrifuge that's spinning faster and faster, and this is one of these rare, really nice times in the series where Bond is really shaken. He doesn't come out of that tossing a casual one-liner, and that humanizes the character and reminds us that Bond isn't an all-powerful cartoon, but somebody who does get into dangerous situations. And there's some pretty good dialogue with scenes with the villain and a lovely score by John Barry, but they don't fit together. And there's really stupid stuff all along. A pigeon doing a double take, the character of Jaws returning and falling in love, and the terrible acting by Lois Chiles. And there's virtually no plot at all until the final half hour, and once Bond gets launched into space, it's all over. It's just too far over the top. We're in some new genre now, having laser gun battles on a space station. I mean, can you look back at From Russia With Love and imagine in your worst nightmares that this is where the series would be going?
I don't think any sane person could, no. Now the question is, the real question we have to ask is, which is worse, The Man with the Golden Gun or Moonraker?
Well, a mutual friend of ours and I have argued over this a lot of times. I think it's The Man with the Golden Gun just because there's nothing good about it, and he says it's the Moonraker because it has the worst stuff of the series in it. Whatever, they're both pretty bad, easily the worst two in any case. And part of the problem is that Bond is supposed to be creating these pop culture fashions. He was ahead of the curve, setting the trends in the 60s, and now we see Bond chasing after other fashions, and it's just the wrong place for Bond to be. But there is good news ahead. If you think producing movies is all about money and never about art, you may be right most of the time, but check this out. Moonraker was wildly successful, the highest grossing of the series in gross dollars, unadjusted for inflation. Probably Thunderball had more admissions, but in any case, highest grossing film of the series, and Albert Broccoli recognized it creatively. Moonraker was a mistake, a failure, and so the next film, For Your Eyes Only, released in 1981, would mark a return to Bond's more grounded, harder-edged roots. The title comes from one of Ian Fleming's short stories. With Moonraker, the titles of the novels had now been exhausted, so the producers started taking titles from the short stories and cobbling bits of plots from different stories together to make a full film. Now, before I talk about it, I want to talk about the character of M, which I haven't covered yet. M is the title given to the head of MI6 in the Bond universe, and it's derived from the tradition in real life, where the head of MI6 would be referred to by his initial. The first to do this would be called C, and that was his last initial. Anyway, M is James Bond's boss, and he was played in the first 11 movies by Bernard Lee, who died of cancer in 1981. Out of respect for him, the character of M was left out of For Your Eyes Only. Now, For Your Eyes Only was directed by John Glenn, and this is the first time directing for him, and he had previously been an editor and second unit director in the series, and his strength is staging and editing action scenes and cranking up the tension. His weakness was the dialogue scenes, which tended to be shot in a relatively uninspired way, but on the whole, Glenn is one of my favorite directors from the series, and he really took the series into a more modern action movie sense, and he would go on to direct all five of the Bond movies made in the 1980s.
Of course, if you're going to hire an astronaut to direct your movie, why not get in for Moonraker?
That was the big mistake of Moonraker, I'm sure. For Your Eyes Only is one of my favorite Bond movies. Scaling Moonraker back into a plot and character-driven suspense film really works. This is really exciting stuff. It's got a pretty solid spy story, unlike anything really from the 1970s, and a great cliff-scaling climax at the end. It also has what I think is the best ski scene. Action scenes on skis is one of the fun trademarks of this series. I've always loved them. The first was in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, and this is the second of Roger Moore's three. Connery's the only Bond to date not to have done a ski scene, but this one's pretty exciting, involving a lot of different elements to the sequence and edited together very well. There's also a very memorable scene where a bad guy is nearly driven off a cliff, and the car is sliding down the incline, and Bond questions him for information and then coldly kicks him off. And this is the first time we've seen Bond exercise his license to kill quite so dramatically since executing Professor Dent in Dr. No. It's a great scene that really demonstrates that Bond is a dangerous character, even when he's played by Roger Moore. One final note about this movie, the pre-credit sequence features, although he's unnamed for legal reasons, the character of Blofeld, who hadn't appeared in the movies for 10 years, and Bond, who is visiting the grave of his wife, finally gets to finish Blofeld off. It was a great way of bringing closure to that story arc, but also a way of sticking it to Kevin McClory, who retained the rights to the character and was really being a hassle for Eon Productions legally. Blofeld's last words are very strange. The line is, "I'll buy you a delicatessen in stainless steel." Nobody liked the line, actually, on the set, but producer Albert Broccoli insisted, allegedly because in the 1930s the New York Mafia would offer delis as bribes, complete with stainless steel countertops, but I think it must be some kind of an inside joke there that we're not really getting. Anyway, the next film is Octopussy, released in 1983, and it basically continues the precedent set by For Your Eyes Only. This is my second favorite of the Moore films, and also features some great suspense scenes, the best being the bit where Bond has to defuse a bomb, and there's a crowd of people that doesn't believe it's there, and just thinks Bond is a nut job, and they try to hold him back. And this is a great scene, because we really get the sense that the worst really could happen. I mean, intellectually, we know Bond will prevail, but we really feel the tension, and sometimes that's rare in some of the weaker Bond movies, because he just seems like so much like a superhero. I should also mention that you know you're doing something right when you can have Bond go undercover as a clown, and it doesn't feel too campy. Anyway, the title character is played well by Maude Adams, whose potential went entirely untapped when she previously appeared as a different character in The Man with the Golden Gun, and she also appears as an extra in A View to a Kill, so she holds the record for appearing in the most Bond films as a non-recurring character. Some other really memorable things in this: a gorgeously exotic setting in India, a memorably Bondian attack weapon that's some kind of circular saw blade yo-yo or something, and that really made an impression on me when I first saw it. And there's also a fantastic pre-credit sequence. The character of M returns, played by this time Robert Brown, although it's not clear if he's supposed to be the same character played by Bernard Lee, or if he's supposed to be a promoted Admiral Hargreaves, who had previously appeared in The Spy Who Loved Me, played by Robert Brown. In any case, he's a crustier, more of a no-nonsense character than the one Lee played, and the writers escalated the friction between Bond and M around this time. Meanwhile, our friend Kevin McClory resurfaces again. He starts production on a remake of Thunderball, with Sean Connery returning to the role after he had previously promised to never play Bond again, hence the title. Eon's legal strategy here was to
wait.
What
is that title?
That title would be Never Say Never Again. Whoops. Eon's legal strategy here was to wait until some serious money had been spent on the project, and then file for an injunction to stop the development, thereby draining McClory of the resources to get his own Bond movie going at all. The plan backfired, and the courts ruled that Eon had waited too long and the project was too far underway, so Never Say Never Again was completed and released to theaters in 1983, along with Octopussy. It was actually originally supposed to open on the same day, but was postponed by a few months. All the same, the media went wild over the Battle of the Bonds. Well, both films were successful, but Octopussy won the battle as it grossed about 10-20% more than Never Say Never Again, just about everywhere except in Italy, where the reverse was true, and at the time Moore was married to an Italian woman, Luigia Mattioli, and he said, "I'll have to speak to Luigia about that."
You've spent way too much time reading about James Bond movies.
Yeah.
If you know that.
Yes.
Okay. Just so we're clear.
Okay. Anyway, Never Say Never Again is weird because it lacks all of the trademarks of the series. The gun barrel opening, the theme music, the familiar actors in the roles of M, Q, and Moneypenny. There was never an established actor playing Felix Leiter, but here he's played by an African-American actor, which is sort of a switch. Incidentally, Leiter will also be a black character in the forthcoming version of Casino Royale. Now, Q, in particular, is terribly mishandled. He's played like he's this sniveling high school nerd or something. It doesn't fit at all. But I think overall, Never Say Never Again is a better movie than Thunderball. It's actually worse in the climax, which really bogs down in both movies, but Never Say Never Again is pretty good and well-directed by Irvin Kershner, best known for directing The Empire Strikes Back. Now, back to the main series. Octopussy was the last film to specify the title of the next Bond movie in the end credits, and all the movies since merely state James Bond will return. And the title listed in Octopussy was From a View to a Kill. Obviously, the title was later shortened to just A View to a Kill. And it's kind of a strange title. It's supposed to refer to fox hunting, but in this movie it's awkwardly made to mean something else. Basically, this movie is kind of like a retread of Goldfinger, and it's a slip back into the campiness that ruined Moonraker, although not quite as bad, but there are some pretty poor moments here, starting right with the otherwise great ski scene opening, where Bond switches from skis to a makeshift snowboard, and the great John Barry music is replaced by the Beach Boys. I thought that was just great when I was however old I was when I saw this, but thankfully I grew out of it.
Which Beach Boys song?
I
vote for California Girls, if I get a pick.
I think it might have been.
Awesome.
But I do still have a soft spot for this one in spite of its flaws. There's quite a lot of action in this one that mostly works, including a spectacular climax on the top of the Golden Gate Bridge, also a memorable villain in Christopher Walken, even though he doesn't really fit into the Bond universe. I mean, the guy is a total nut job, like he is in pretty much every movie. There's a scene where he just up and takes a machine gun to his contract workers, and he guns them all down and laughs the whole time. It's freaky, and I'm not really sure it fits.
Well, you know, that was actually not scripted. Christopher Walken just had a machine gun.
Oh, okay.
They happened to be filming at the time.
Now it makes sense to me. Yeah. Okay. Well, the Bond girls this time are Tanya Roberts, who surely holds the record for screeching James the most times in the most annoying way possible, and Grace Jones, who is the personification of everything weird and wrong and bad about the 1980s. But you know what? John Barry's spectacular score, probably the best he'd done in the series since On Her Majesty's Secret Service, practically redeems the whole affair. A number of scenes are made memorable entirely thanks to the music, particularly a scene where Bond carries Tanya Roberts out of a burning building and the music makes it strangely moving. Barry also teamed up with the pop rock group Duran Duran to compose the title theme, which is arguably the best of the Bond theme songs, certainly the biggest hit on the charts. So that completes the Roger Moore years. It's also the end of Lois Maxwell's run in the series, who played Moneypenny in every film since Dr. No, so she starred in a total of 14. But as for Roger Moore, he made 7 movies all told, initially thinking he'd quit after Moonraker, then again after Octopussy. But he says he knew that it was finally time to throw in the towel when he realized that Tanya Roberts' mother was younger than he was. And he said later, quote, "Looking back, I realized I did look as old as I felt." Interestingly, I think people complain more about Connery's age in Never Say Never Again, but Roger Moore is actually older than Sean Connery and made his last Bond 2 years after Connery made his. Anyway, next week we will talk about the Timothy Dalton and Pierce Brosnan years.
And you can defend why you think Dalton is the best of the Bonds, right?
Absolutely.
All right, yep. Looking forward to that.
Closing our very special Halloween episode of All Movie Talk, we're going to do a very appropriate entry in our Good Bad Movie series of segments, which are all about finding the entertainment and unintentional humor in really, really awful movies. Our favorite bad movie of all time is Sinbad of the Seven Seas, which we talked about in episode 2, so check that out if you missed it. But today, we're going to talk about the black sheep in the Halloween series of films, and that's Halloween 3, Season of the Witch. The Halloween movies, as you may know, are all about an unstoppable masked serial killer named Michael Myers, created by John Carpenter and Deborah Hill, who wrote the first Halloween movie, and that came out in 1978. Carpenter directed the first movie and produced the first 3. But Halloween 3 doesn't have anything to do with Michael Myers at all. John Carpenter's plan after the second one was to turn the Halloween franchise into a series of unrelated stories with a Halloween theme to them. So Halloween 3 is a self-contained story, and when that came out, it was completely ridiculous, and nobody liked it, so that's why they brought back Michael Myers for part 4.
Right, and the same thing happened with Friday the 13th. I think Friday the 13th part 5, like, doesn't have Jason in it at all, and it has some guy dressed up as Jason, and the plan was to have Jason be a different person in each movie, and everyone hated it, so of course they just brought him back to life again in part 6. Pretend like part 5 didn't happen.
It'd be better to pretend the whole series didn't happen, but anyway. Let's talk about this movie. This movie, I think, has the most ridiculous plot in the history of movies, and that's saying a lot. In fact, you know, I don't think I could make up a funnier plot synopsis if I tried. Let me run it by you. It seems a mad scientist has stolen Stonehenge. And I'm not sure how, but he just up and took it and put it in his basement.
Wait, now, was this the mini Stonehenge from Spinal Tap?
No, this was the full thing. This is the whole the actual Stonehenge. He stole it and put it in his elaborate James Bond-esque hideout. And the reason is so that he and his android minions can put pieces of it inside these microchips, and the microchips will be embedded inside Halloween masks, and the masks are sold in stores nationwide, and kids everywhere will be wearing them on Halloween night as they watch TV. Because kids always watch TV on Halloween night.
Oh, I know, I sure did. Who wants to go trick-or-treating when you could watch sitcoms?
With your mask on.
Exactly.
Right. And so the mad scientist has arranged for a particular commercial to play on television at this time, and the commercial will send out a signal through your TV that will activate the microchip inside the mask and cause the microchips to shoot lasers through people's heads. Why are you laughing? This is serious stuff. This is a global threat. But it's not just any laser. These are special lasers that when they hit people in the head, cause their mouths to open too wide and bugs and snakes crawl out of it.
And I hate it when that happens.
Yeah, it's a real drag. I mean,
they should really outlaw those snake lasers.
So, do I really have to say anything more? That synopsis pretty much describes what you're going to get in this movie. And the weird thing is, this is played totally straight. A lot of cheap slasher movies, especially in the 80s, really play up the camp, but this is, like, serious. People are, I don't know, I don't know how the producers could have taken this seriously, but I guess they did.
Yeah, at some point in time, someone sat down and said, you know what would be scary? Snake lasers. I don't think we can actually overstate how ridiculous the climax is. The masks shoot out lasers and snakes. What? It's the weirdest thing. I can only imagine that everyone involved in this movie, from the writer to the director to the gaffers and the carpenters and craft services, that they were all high as a kite to even want to be involved with something like this. Snake lasers. Let me just say that one more time. I haven't said it enough. Snake lasers. That's what you're supposed to be afraid of.
Powered by Stonehenge.
Well, what else is it going to be powered by? You can't just use Duracell in that. You gotta get real power. Stonehenge.
Right. So, this dastardly plot is uncovered via giant, suicidal leaps in logic. Like this one. The hero first suspects a huge conspiracy at the Halloween mask factory because his father died saying, "They'll kill us all," while holding a Halloween mask in his hand. Makes sense, right?
Well, makes about as much sense as the Da Vinci Code. And that was a huge hit, so I'm fine with it so far.
So our generic hero and generic heroine are on the case, and they fall hopelessly in love with each other after about 5 seconds, and eventually they wind up at the bad guy's hideout, and suddenly we're in a James Bond movie, as I said before, because the bad guy turns around and looks and says, "Ah, oh, Mr. Chalice," and invites him into his hideout and gives him a tour of Stonehenge and everything. Of course, up to now, all his henchmen have been trying to kill them, but once they get inside, well, now you're welcome, and I'll tell you everything what we're doing.
Well, you know, I mean, it's just part of being a good host, really. You can't just kill your guests as soon as they walk in. You have to put them in some sort of death trap first. Right. That's proper etiquette.
And it's kind of funny because he says, "A good magician never explains," and then this remark prefaces his complete explanation of his entire scheme, after which he puts the hero in an elaborate death machine, of course, and leaves him alone so he can escape.
Well, the bad guy's not saying that he himself is a good magician. He's saying,
all right, I get it now.
Never explain, "I'm not a good magician, here's the explanation."
So this death machine, by the way, is just great. Basically, he puts one of the masks on him, ties him to a chair, and makes him watch TV. So that when the commercial airs, he'll die along with everybody else with bugs and snakes crawling out of his laser-shot head. Anyway, how does he escape? Well, he kicks a hole in the TV, and he frees himself from his bonds by somehow taking off his mask, and with a flick of his fingers, because that's all he can move, his wrists are still bound, so he flicks his fingers a little bit and accurately throws this mask at a security camera on the other side of the room and breaks it.
That's a heavy mask.
He's still tied up, though, right? So the movie cuts to something else and then cuts back again, and when it cuts back, suddenly he's magically got this shard of glass from the TV in his hands. Because, you know, who knows how he got it. The filmmakers couldn't think of a way, so they just cut it. Anyway, he cuts the ropes with that and escapes. And then the androids start chasing him around, so he grabs a box of the laser microchips, the snake laser microchips, and climbs up some scaffolding and dumps out the microchips. And obviously when the microchips hit the floor, they turn into blue lightning because, you know, that's just what happens.
That's the power of Stonehenge for you, baby.
Yes, and the blue lightning shoots and kills all the androids with very accurate precision. And the other thing that's neat is, you know, he's got this little box in his hands and he dumps it, and then we cut to the floor, and there's a huge cascade of microchips that hit the floor. It's just way, way more than ever could have fit in that little box, but, you know, whatever. There's a lot of androids to kill with the blue lightning. So, at this point, the big boss bad guy shows up again, and suddenly he is aware that Stonehenge is about to shoot lasers at his head. So he gives our hero a little nod of professional admiration just before he bites it. And the hero rescues the heroine, and they go speeding off in a car. But wait, it turns out that our heroine has actually become an android.
Oh, no.
Never mind how it happened, it did. And he tries to kill our hero. So the car runs into a tree, and the hero kills the android repeatedly by lopping off parts of its anatomy. It's like the Black Knight, because it's hilarious. No matter how many times he chops limbs off, they keep moving and trying to get him. You know how there's always that he's not really dead moment? Because you've killed the bad guy, and then you're just kind of walking around, and suddenly he comes to life again and grabs your ankle or something. There's so many of these moments. I can't even tell you how many times it happens here. And disembodied pieces of the android woman keep coming back to life to kill this guy.
You know, Sam, if I've said it once, I've said it a million times. The only effective method of killing androids is the snake laser. He should have used one.
He should have, yes. Well, and this movie is proof of that. Because the car crash rips its arm off and it's all over. And then suddenly, with an electronic shriek cord, she attacks him again and he punches her head off. And it's all over. And suddenly, with an electronic shriek cord, the arm attacks, the disembodied arm. And so he throws that away, and it's all over. And then suddenly, with an electronic shriek cord, the torso attacks, and he punches it, and it's all over. And I was really expecting the head to come back alive again and start biting his ankles. And unfortunately, this is the one thing where the movie exercised some restraint on, I guess. So the conclusion here is, this is a terrible movie if you watch it as a serious horror movie, but if you can stomach the violence and gore, because it is kind of a bit nasty in places, and really nasty in an unpleasant way, too. But if you can deal with that, this is a hilarious movie to laugh at, and I think of a lot of unintentional funny movies, it's best to see it with a group of like-minded people making cracks at the movie as it plays.
Also, snake lasers. I had to say it one more time.
Earlier in the episode, we had a very expensively produced trivia question about horror musical motifs.
It frightened me. I'm actually still a little scared from those sounds.
A little quivery about that, yeah. I got all the lights on. I turned them on after we were done recording that. But anyway, do you remember what they were?
Yeah, I think I do.
Okay, well let's hear your rendition of number one.
All right, well, I spent some time on this one. I think it goes something like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Again, you went four repetitions. There's three, and then it goes down a couple of notes, and then it repeats.
I know movies, not music, man.
Okay, well, what is that one from?
That's the sting is from Psycho.
Yes, the notes from Psycho. I guess it's to simulate a knife slashing.
Boy, does it work.
Number two is...
Da-dum.
What's that from?
We're going to need a bigger boat. That's Jaws.
Yeah, there's a great anecdote about this one. John Williams, of course, composed the soundtrack for it, and he came up to Steven Spielberg, you know, as they were making the movie, and he said, "Hey, I've been working really hard on the score. Would you like to hear it?" And Spielberg said, "Sure." And so they went over to a piano, and John Williams sat down, and he played da-dum. He said, "What do you think?" And Spielberg said, "Is that it?" And John Williams said, "Well, I think that's all you need." And, of course, he was right. Obviously, there's more to the score than that, but it's all based on this little two-note motif. And I think it's really fascinating how little you can have and still have something that we can identify and that resonates with us.
So I imagine that after Spielberg heard the completed score, he was like, well, I'm going to just have that guy score every one of my movies for the rest of my life.
And that continues to this day. So that brings us to number three.
And that's from the Friday the 13th movies.
Yes.
Which allegedly, and I just checked it on a website called pitofhorror.com.
Wait, whoa. You look up the answers when I ask them and before we get to the end and you've looked them up?
No, I already knew it. I went to go look up this little fact.
Steven, you can't prove you knew it before now.
I had to know what it was to look it up, Chief.
Oh.
You can't just type... into Google, unless you have the new audio Google. But according to pitofhorror.com, which, you know, must be correct, and this is what I was thinking it was, so it confirms me, and if it confirms me, it must be right. It says that the effect was to simulate the idea that Miss Voorhees, who was, of course, the killer in the first Friday the 13th movie, heard the words kill and mommy over and over. So you hear the key, or k in kill, and ma.
Okay, that's great, Stephen, but you're a liar. I just typed that into Google, and the first search result was Friday the 13th music references. Gah, I can't believe you'd betray me like that.
How did you type that? What letters did you use?
K-I-K-I-K-I-H-A-H-A-H-A.
See, it's not H-A-H-A-H-A, it's M-A-M-A-M-A.
But that's what I typed, and it came up with Friday the 13th musical references.
Well, I just typed it the way I would have typed it, and it didn't come up.
Gah, liar.
So this is pretty much the end of our first full month here, at the end of our Halloween episode number 5, good round number. And we want to go ahead and give a couple of thank yous to some people who have really helped us out. In particular, of course, all of our listeners and all the participants on our website, allmovietalk.com. As always, if you know the name of the show, All Movie Talk, you know the name of the website, allmovietalk.com. We've got a lot of happening topics up there. You know, we keep it updated throughout the week, and there's a lot of good discussion. Also want to thank Brad Gersh, a.k.a. Counterpoint, who sequenced the music for our theme music, which is really nice because the music is a public domain song. We actually had him make the MIDI, which is why our opening sounds so much better than if Sam and I had tried to compose something.
Exactly. I'd also like to thank a couple of people who are behind the scenes but put up with a lot for our recording sessions. And so what happens is on a Saturday, usually Stephen and I will arrange a time and we'll record. And we don't have recording studios or anything because All Movie Talk has not quite made enough money for us to afford our own office space. So I'm in my living room and my wife has to leave. She's banished during recording sessions. And so that's an inconvenience, but I really appreciate that. So thanks to Darlene and also to Stephanie, because Stephen doesn't have a real computer, apparently. It won't record. There's a technical issue with that. And so he has to use Stephanie's computer, and she has to play The Sims on his computer. And so we really appreciate the two of you and also everyone Stephen mentioned. Next week on our show, we have an episode that's thematically about movies that are about movies. We'll have a top six list on that subject and also spotlight a movie that is about the movies. And, of course, we'll be continuing our discussion about James Bond, and there's a whole bunch of other great stuff, so don't miss it next week.
Cut.